Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everyone. Nice to see such a great group of Bay Area business leaders here in tonight's conversation, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. Accenture is honored to support tonight's program. It'll be an informative and thoughtful conversation around how companies can drive innovation in the digital economy. I'm personally looking forward to the conversation, both because driving innovation is something that is core to Accenture and what we do, and also because I have the privilege of leading Accenture's relationship with Cisco, where we have a track record of co-innovation, which is exciting. So I'd like to introduce our two speakers for the evening, Alex Gorchev and Maciej Krantz. For the past 20 years, Alex has made it his business to turn disruptive concepts into emerging business models. As Cisco's Managing Director of Innovation Strategy and Programs, he sparks internal innovation by providing employees at all levels the chance to share their big ideas, many of which will make their way into the company's innovation engine. Maciej brings 30 years of networking industry experience to his position as Vice President of the Corporate Strategic Innovation Group at Cisco. He leads the group focused on incubating new businesses, accelerating internal innovation, and driving co-innovation with customers and partners through a global network of Cisco innovation centers. Alex and Maciej will discuss the disruptive impact of digitization on industries, their operations, cultures, and employees. They'll also share best practices that enable companies to lead in the digital transition and how they can help maintain leadership in a highly competitive marketplace. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator. Ravi Balani is the co-founder of Alchemist Accelerator and a lecturer on entrepreneurship at Stanford University. So welcome, Ravi, Alex, and Maciej.
Sorry, they wanted.
You're already bossing me around.
Well, I am the moderator. I have to be by the gavel. I was trying to follow Commonwealth procedure. So thank you, John, for that introduction, and thank you everybody for joining us. Just very quickly before we kick off, by show of hands, how many people are working at a startup right now? And how many people are working at what you would not classify as a startup or as a big company? Okay, so, and then how many people are interested in starting something potentially? Okay, so it looks like we have a crowd of potential founders and a minority of each of corporates and startups. So with that, let me kick it off just by opening it up, by asking you both. We have two of the top luminaries here on innovation. What excites you most right now when it comes to innovation in the digital ecosystem, either in terms of an innovation itself or in terms of an aspect of how innovation is changing? And I'll kick it off with Maciej.
Sounds good. So, you know, just to give you some context, so Alex and I, we got stranded at the airport for a couple of hours. And speaking of innovation, I was what was coming to my mind was personal drones, holograms, and teleporting, right? But putting these things aside, so maybe I'll age myself, but I would say since the the advent of commercial internet, 28 years ago, I would say that technology is probably at the point where we see the most acceleration, whether this is Internet of Things, AI, blockchain, distributed cloud, fog computing, all the buzzwords. And the consequence of this is that we are seeing multiple disruptions. Another sort of cliche statement, but every industry is becoming a technology industry. We're seeing industries merging, new industries emerging. We're seeing new value propositions, new business models. So it's a fun time to be in the space, I would say. Yep.
Yeah, it is the renaissance, I think, of tech right now. I mean, I think it has been for a while. Alex, what excites you the most right now?
Kind of two things. On the trends, it's about globalization. It's the whole idea that ideas can come from anywhere. And globally, and we're seeing people work together across the universe, and it's truly come together as teams in one companies. I think the second one is about inclusion and diversity. Innovation is about inclusion and diversity. All is it about? It's about people with different ideas coming together and different perspectives and life experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty impressive, and that's what keeps the growth. And I think Maciej mentioned few technologies. Just on a personal note, I'm fascinated with voice and kind of as a technology. I have a 4-year-old in the house, and he discovered Alexa, right? And we were recently on vacation in LA, and he was like, "Daddy, where's Alexa? What weather is today?" And there's like, "Why didn't we take Alexa to the trip with us?" So the fact that a 4-year-old can access a lot of information, he doesn't even know how to type, right? He doesn't even know letters, but yet he's able to go and process and access a lot of data. That's pretty amazing.
And especially at that age, you have sort of co-evolution of humans with technology.
But he expects Roomba to follow the voice command. I mean, everything needs to be Alexa enabled, right?
So, you have to be careful. You might be raising somebody who's used to getting something on demand. But let me throw it back to Mahatchek. So just going further into this notion of this is an exciting time of innovation, and innovation is flourishing from a whole bunch of different spots. But I want to start thinking about, you know, in Silicon Valley, and I know innovation's global, we talk about being a land of elephants and unicorns. This notion that unicorns is this designation that we give. It is the Silicon Valley version of a safari. And I think most people, if you say safari, they're thinking about a browser in Silicon Valley. But the but this notion the Silicon Valley analog of a unicorn is a designation we give to a startup that has hit a $1 billion valuation. Mm-hmm. And then we have these elephants, which Cisco is among is a leader among leaders of incumbents that are holding down the fort.
Positive statement.
But if we look at unicorns right now, the pace of unicorns is increasing. Some people say it's increasing too quickly. And the rate of ascent of these startups becoming billion-dollar companies is also accelerating, as you were talking about earlier about the acceleration. Slack, I think, is an example of a startup most recently that's probably had the shortest unicorn puberty period in history, mm-hmm. where they went from launch to a billion-dollar valuation in 9 months. Mm-hmm. How do the elephants respond? Can incumbents be as progressive in innovation as the startups? Or said another way, can elephants dance? And if so, how? What are the hidden insights about tactically about how they can? And can you evidence how those tactics have actually worked?
All kinds of images come to mind here, but you know, I probably would give a little bit of different perspective.
Okay.
So one way of looking at the valley, I just realized I think I've been around here for 30 years. So is looking at the size of the company, is looking at sort of longevity of the company. The other way of looking at this is. And I would sort of look into what how Peter Diamandis looks at things, which is organizations that do incremental innovations versus disruptive or exponential innovations. And if you look at the startups, at least from my experience, the clear majority of the startups are focusing on, I would say, incremental innovations. So finding the hole somewhere between the big elephants and see if they can fit their stuff in, improving slightly and hopefully hoping to get bought. And occasionally, we come across unique opportunities, like during my youth, like Netscape or Cisco or early Google, that create new markets, that create these exponential innovations. And I would say the same thing happens in the stable of elephants, using your analogy, which is that most of the time when you run multi-billion-dollar businesses, you focus on incremental innovations. So you focus on growing your business. You know, I sort of joke, as long as you have a product manager on the business will continue to go, right? But then occasionally, you also have an opportunity to create new markets, to grow new markets. I've actually been fortunate at Cisco to actually be part of multiple of these types of experiences. Because you could argue that larger companies actually, with their focus, their breadth, and their impact, actually are very well positioned, if they do it right, to create these new markets or to substantially grow the markets. So for me, it's creating the right environments where more enterprises, more large enterprises, can be disruptive, But also, I would say it's true for the startups, to identify startups that are more disruptive. If you look at unicorns, I would actually argue that a lot of these unicorns are not actually doing a lot of disruptive work. So from that perspective, that's sort of my angle, is okay. Look at the true innovation versus valuation, age, T-shirts, and other things, right?
Fair enough. Okay, so Alex, you're also a Cisco exec, and so I'm going to double-click on Maciek's comments and throw it to you, which is, if we believe then that the elephants are in this unique position to do real disruptive innovation, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the Fortune 500 companies today, the half-life of being a Fortune 500 company seems like it's shrinking. Like, I think they say that the average duration now is 30 years to be at the Fortune 500, and only 10% of the companies that were Fortune 500 companies in the 50s are still in the Fortune 500. If there's any company that can prove to be an exception to that rule, it could be Cisco, because Cisco is almost a city of founders in many ways. It's done some incredibly disruptive things that no other company has done when it comes to innovation. Now, a recent HBR article talked about how this whole notion about corporate entrepreneurship is a myth. We can pay lip service to it, but at the end of the day, if you look at the bureaucracy of getting anything done within a big corporation, the fear of failure, the focus on short-term results, corporate entrepreneurship is an oxymoron. Do you agree with that, with sentiment that the HBR article was encapsulating? And if not, can you share some secrets on how Cisco is able to overcome the resistance that causes failure where others who are equally, you know, well-equipped in terms of money and resources fail?
Yeah, first of all, I disagree. I understand there are some challenges in big companies, right? And mostly because startups, it's a very team sport, right? I remember I worked for Napster, and every day I would like wake up and go to the office, including Saturdays and Sundays, right? It's just it's a team sport versus a large company is a political process. Having said that, if you're an entrepreneur and innovator, it's a mindset. You can't really cut it. So there's a lot of debate. Oh, they're not investing in innovation, or they're cutting innovation. You can't cut what you believe in, right? So it's all about creating the right culture and hiring the right people, and most importantly, retaining the right people. At Cisco, there are many ways we're doing that. There's a couple of things I wanted to highlight. First one is you mentioned the city of founders. So we do have a founders forum. Every single person that comes in from a company, CEO or a CXO of a company that we've acquired, sits on this founders forum, and basically they work with business units, they work with employees to advise them and to make sure that the spirit of the startup keeps going. The other one, it's about truly about, I go back to inclusion and diversity, right? It's about giving the employees voice. Again, why are startups very successful? It's typically a very small, a very cohesive team with not a lot of politics, and everyone is in together. And that's primarily because every single opinion is heard. Right, everybody knows each other. Everybody knows what the strategy is and how folks are connected. So it's about connecting employees together and making them feel valued. And most importantly, it's about connecting employees with strategy. When you think about the large company, many people who work in a large company, they don't even know the product portfolio or what the strategy is. Versus in a startup, startup may not have a strategy, but everybody feels that they're aligned with a vision. Right. So I think it's very important to connect employees with strategy as well.
And many people talk about connecting employees with strategy, but few people actually deliver. Are there any, is there any secrets or any unintuitive insights? I've always been impressed with like Cisco's spin-in program. I don't know if that is something that, you know, that was a really bold initiative and other creative constant experiments that Cisco's doing. But are there any other unintuitive insights that you want to share with people that are wrestling with corporate innovation?
Well, there's one intuitive. We've actually encouraged people to go and work with the outside ecosystem, right? So if our employees have ideas, we actually get them in front of customers through the innovation centers. And when I've heard that idea in the beginning, when it was pitched to me, I said, it's crazy. Let's kill it immediately, right? It's a bad idea. But I was convinced that it's actually good to get employees involved with customers early on with their ideas, and most importantly, get employees to participate, volunteer with startups, sit on the boards, and basically bring in the outside influence. There is a lot of risk factor to that. They might leave, but the worst is they'll stay and they'll be disengaged, right?
Maciek, thoughts on this cross-pollination between?
Yeah, can I talk, yeah. Give my perspective? Because if I look at, again, the special place, the Valley, right, and And there were so many books written about this that we created this sort of a this virtuous cycle over the last 40 years, right? When you have a lot of research initially funded by government, increasingly now more by individuals or corporations, we have a whole network of angels, accelerators, VC, multiple exit options. So we created an environment for entrepreneurs to flourish. And even in this environment, especially the first-time entrepreneurs, I think it's really, really hard to get going. In the large enterprises, what is different is that we need to... So to enable entrepreneurs, we actually need to create a similar sort of environment, right, where you can actually have the way to fund these efforts. You need to have a culture. You need to have the mentor structures and so forth. Once you create the structure, and that's what, to some degree, Alex, what you did, mm-hmm. right, then I think you can expect that there will be entrepreneurs who will take advantage of it, and they will actually sort of drive the movement. Without creating this kind of a structure, it's really, really hard to be entrepreneurial in a large company.
And does that to mix a bunch of different analogies, but is this cross-pollination between unicorns and elephants and or between the internal and the external, does that extend beyond just customers and employees? Do you believe in cross-pollinating internal employees with other external partners? How do you guys, is that a critical role? How do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what we've done, right? Not only customers, but partners, but just getting engaged in the community, right? Getting to know your local startup accelerators, right? Basically just being out there. I think that brings back a lot of ideas and really helps our employees feel more engaged, and it really helps Cisco with fresh ideas, and it helps startups because they have a lot of experience, right? And the other thing is most of the startups don't want to stay startups, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to grow bigger, and this is where the large companies can go and help them mm-hmm. because it comes down to process, discipline, and scale, right? Not necessarily the T-shirts. And
I mean, one of the things that Alex, your team does is, right, you guys run the network of innovation or co-innovation centers, right? And I think this is a great example where we have, when you think about your startup, why would you want to engage with a large company? Of course, you can get funding or whatever, but you can get funding from different sources. You want to get access to customers, you want to get access to partners, right? And that's in some way what we do in innovation centers. We get, we engage with the customers, with partners, and bring in startups to develop these solutions that then we can replicate and sell to everybody else.
Okay.
If I may add to that, startups bring a lot of business, right? Because there's a lot of companies that are interested in their niche solutions, but they, at the end of the day, they need the credibility and they need the support and scalability, and that's where we can help and like nobody else can.
Okay. Let me shift it towards talent then and the future innovators that would be potentially joining Cisco. A recent Accenture report found that only 14% of grads would want to work for a big corporation because they fear that a big corporation would not really be looking out for their individual interests. I will say, as a lecturer at Stanford, that for my undergrads, even the idea of staying at one place for more than 5 years can cause an allergic reaction, let alone the notion of a lifelong career, which was sort of the foundation of many of the great companies, is that you had employees that committed themselves for their full lives. Are you concerned by this trend with millennials sort of towards these, towards not committing within or not trusting big corporates as being the place for them? And if so, what are you guys, if anything, doing about that?
Yeah. I'm generally concerned with lack of commitment whenever that happens, right? But look, at the end of the day, I think when you're younger, right, basically you're not, it's basically fun versus stability, right? And figuring out what you want to do. But I think if we look at the same report, it talks about the fact that it's all about sense of community, and it's all about being listened to, right? It's a sense of belonging ultimately, and kind of following your own passions. So as long as big companies can create that environment, and going back to the culture and inclusion of diversity and respect for opinions and giving every employee a voice, I think that could change that.
Okay. I 100% agree with that, but I can also give you an example. So I think it was maybe 7 or 10 years ago, we kicked off an IoT effort and a business unit. And And I think the concept here was, wow, this is this great new opportunity, and we can change the market, we can create the market. And to be honest, I was getting a lot of calls not only from Stanford students, but even professors who wanted to join the effort, right?
Yes.
So I think this, part of this is community, part of this is giving voice, part of this is inspiring as well.
Fantastic. We're starting to get questions from the audience, and so I want to make sure that those get voiced as well. One question is asking, if a company is truly innovative, why have an R&D team and an innovation incubator? If you're truly succeeding, why do you need both? And if we look at, you know, just to add to this question, if you look at the R&D data, we spend about 10 times as much money on R&D every year as we do in venture capital. I think it's around $500 billion is spent in R&D, and about $50 billion is spent in venture capital. And R&D seems like it's woefully underperforming. There's very little correlation between how much you spend in R&D and how innovative you are. The most innovative companies aren't the ones, the biggest R&D spenders. If you look at correlations of R&D against revenue, there's very little correlation. So any comments or that you want to address about if you're truly innovative, why do you need both R&D and an incubator, or how do you think about that?
I think at least from my perspective, I think it's you're absolutely right that for me, sort of innovation, as we talked earlier, innovation sort of is a mindset, right? And there is definitely a tendency, if you're running a multi-billion-dollar business, that you want to be predictable, you want to deliver every quarter, you want to make sure that your customers have visibility into your roadmap. So naturally, there's a lot of forces that drive you to become sort of more, I would say, serial, and then sort of incremental. But at the same time, to Alex's earlier point, if you have a 5,000-person engineering organization, you have an option of running it as a very structured organization with top-down processes and so on, whatever. Or you can divide this team into 150-person teams. Mm-hmm. You will have more chaos. Mm-hmm. You have more overlap, but you will get some amazing results. Mm-hmm. So again, I know I sound like a broken record. I don't think it's a size, it's how that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. I think to add to that, it really depends on how you define an R&D and what industry it's in. If we think about the life sciences industry or pharmaceuticals, right, there's a longer development cycle, there's regulatory concerns, so you have to approach this differently. But if you think about R&D, like in the old age, some smart people go and lock themselves in a building for a year and they have a 10-year plan. That's unlikely to happen just because there's a lot of information that's happening and you need to stay connected to that. But if R&D is about listening to others and getting others involved and responding quickly, then that's, again, it's all in terminology.
Which companies would you consider to be the most innovative and why?
Obviously, Cisco.
Cisco, of course. Father.
Accenture.
We'll play homage to Father Cisco and Accenture. Of course, beyond the obvious, Cisco and Accenture. Which other companies do you think are the most innovative?
You know, actually, I meet with a lot of companies, and it's sort of fascinating because I recently remember meeting with 3M, for example, and it's funny because we end up spending a couple of hours together, and we usually just teach each other. So maybe I'll give you a cop-out answer, which is that every company that I met with from a Fortune 1000 has some aspects of innovation that I think I've learned that are new. Very few companies are collecting sort of all of these into a bucket to make them truly innovative across all the domains.
And so none?
Very few.
Well, very few. Any names associated with those very few?
Let me get back with you. I'll think about it. I'll think about some names.
Alex, any? That is
said it all.
Okay. Well, let me just push on this a bit because, you know, I think some people would argue that one of the big innovation areas is around AI. And what's ironic is that we haven't seen that many big unicorn AI companies. In fact, the big companies seem to be getting stronger when it comes to AI. Besides Cisco, you're seeing big companies like Apple and Amazon and Facebook and Google that seem to be becoming bigger and bigger.
Alibaba, Baidu.
Alibaba, Baidu. Yep. Should we be concerned or emboldened when we're seeing a bulk of the innovation being concentrated in a few big companies. Does that comfort you or does that concern you?
How much time do we have? So, you know, for me, just maybe to start with, I actually think that AI is in the same sort of in the same stage right now as I would say IoT and blockchain, which is we're primarily focusing on solving or optimizing existing processes. But similarly to these other domains, I expect that there will be sort of two different camps that will be emerging. The first one would be I would say the horizontal providers, people that actually build AI capabilities, big data centers with training capabilities and so forth. And I think that the companies you mentioned, I think, are sort of pushing in this category. But I also think there will be a lot of companies that will actually focus very deeply on solving particular problems, workflows or vertical problems, where they actually need in-depth expertise. At the end of the day, machine learning is just yet another tool, right? And how do you use the tool is actually the key. So I think that even though you would see thousands of AI experts sitting in these large enterprises, I think there's plenty of room for nimble startups to focus specific use cases that take advantage of these large companies' capabilities to change industries.
Okay. Alex, is that, yeah.
I think the other advantage that large companies have is they're sitting on a lot of data and they can make a lot of connections with that data. And that's what I'm concerned about personally as a consumer, but yeah.
Yeah, you are concerned a bit as a consumer.
Yeah.
So we have a question here from the audience on, can you comment on blockchain as an example of innovation? Is blockchain overrated or underrated, just to start off?
I'm a big believer in blockchain. So, and of course, there's hype. There's hype around AI. There's hype around IoT. Although we're sort of moving into sort of a reality now. But we've actually been involved in blockchain for a couple of years, and I think that, like with everything else, sort of sorting through what is real, what is not, has been sort of the first order of priority. So, to give you a sense. There's a lot of hype around application of blockchains in the financial industry. One of the holy grails that has been talked about is reducing the time of sort of reconciliation and of your stock transactions from 3 days to zero. But when you, if you actually look at this, you find that there's actually a lot of these kind of solutions already out in the market without the need for blockchain. There is a lot of incentives for the business, for the players in the business to actually keep your money for 3 days. So then it turned out to be a red herring, right? So, but at the same time, there are lots of exciting, legitimate use cases, whether they are in supply chain or even in finance, like, for example, syndicated lending, where you truly have a problem of multiple parties doing a lot of transactions together, and they can actually benefit from a sort of a single point of truth and a trust platform. I do believe that blockchain will actually change networking. It will change a lot of industries. Like for example, from a networking perspective, I would expect in 10 years we'll be instead of switching packets, we'll be switching transactions. So it will have a big impact.
Yep. Yep. Is there, and Maciek, you're the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Building the Internet of Things.
You actually quoted
Is there an either Internet of Thing, IoT, or blockchain-enabled product that you think is going to happen in the next 10 years that's on nobody's radar right now that no one's thinking about?
I think there were plenty of them. I think we're just at the beginning of the journey. And I think, you know, technology is fairly new. We are sort of at the point where we're starting to see the migration of blockchain technologies into enterprise from sort of the overhype of cryptocurrencies, right? And definitely yes. You know, I was at a conference like a couple of weeks ago, and And somebody asked the question to the analyst, so who do you think will be the winners in the blockchain space? And his answer was really interesting. It's sort of like, look at AltaVista and Yahoo. They were sort of the early movers, but then came Google. And I think the same will be in blockchain, which is I don't think we have seen sort of the major shifts happening yet.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Alex, I'm going to shift it to ethics. We have a question from the audience on what ethical considerations must innovators adhere to? And especially, you know, in the zeitgeist today, corporate policy and ethics is, I think, seldom has it been as actively debated and discussed across a variety of different elements. Can you speak to if ethics play a role at all in how Cisco thinks about innovation? And if so, are there any ethics that you think that corporate innovators need to adhere to?
Well, speaking about ethics, I think a good example of a typical concern that folks have is around kind of the startup and large company collaboration. Because typically when you work with startups, there's this perception that a big company is going to steal your IP or they're going to take your idea. And so that's one school of thought. Another school of thought is a lot of people are afraid to kind of discuss their ideas and put them even in the market because they want to create that perfect thing and they feel that others will take their ideas away. And I think from an ethics standpoint, from a reality standpoint, that rarely happens. The big companies are not out there to steal startup ideas. They actually want to partner with startups and they want to make startups successful. Worse, they might acquire a startup legally, right? And from an employee perspective, and just from an individual innovator perspective, great ideas are made by listening and collaborating with others. The lonely innovator is a myth, and I think it's very important that people shift their perception and go and work with others. And I think there's a lot of ethics concerns around both of those topics.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and we can talk. And so there's the ethics around interacting with partners, and also we've been talking a lot about startups and incumbents and the ethics around that. But how about the ethics?
Small and large companies.
Small and large. what did I say? Oh, start. Yes, you can be a startup entrepreneur as much as so incumbents versus small companies emerging to become great companies. But let's also talk. What about? Are there any ethics around humans versus machines? So as you know, we saw you know amongst sort of there were reports out recently about how Facebook famously had to shut down two AI bots because I think it was Alice and Bob because they were developing a language that nobody in the research lab could understand, or Microsoft similarly shut down Tay. And there's this broader notion about you know this idea of the singularity that we are inevitably unfurling towards this trigger point where you're going to have AI superintelligence that's going to reach a point of criticality where it's going to unravel at a pace that humanity can no longer even predict. Should we be concerned? And are there any ethical obligations on innovators when it comes to thinking about the forward pace of AI and technology? And then I think underneath that is, do you actually believe in a singularity? Do you believe that there will be this point of no return where technology will go beyond the grasp of humanity? And if so, when is that happening? If it hasn't happened already. A bunch of different threads there. You can pick off on any of those.
No, this is interesting. I actually do believe that we live in a matrix already. So it's like if you actually put this aside. There's obviously a lot of debate, as you mentioned, and my assessment or my sense is that we are far, far away from general AI, right? So from that perspective, sort of this vision of singularity in this very singular way, I think it's far, far away. Tim O'Reilly, actually, he recently published a book, and he talked about sort of a hybrid AI, and I actually do agree with him. So that the sort of the view, the world where we have a lot of very specialized neural AI systems interacting with humans, and if we think that this is sort of the way to accomplish singularity, that it is going to happen sort of in the next 5 to 10 years, right? But you know, for me, I'm not in the camp of sort of an alarmist crew. But at the same time, I do see the reason and the value, the same way we put a lot of effort with chemical weapons, with biological weapons to actually put some stopgaps in place. I think sort of putting in the right rules of behavior so that we actually focus on the positive side of the AI versus negative side of AI, I think it's definitely important. And I think that the broader AI community is, I think, organizing themselves around that effort.
Alex, any thoughts?
Two things, just to echo on what Maciek said. On a personal level, it's like everything that I was reading when I was growing up, reading in science fiction books is happening, right? And obviously that is a big theme about technology.
We did it in the Matrix. So
yeah, about the technology taking over. But on the save blocks, I think it's all about, again, it's going back to the data, right? It's about data governance and making sure that we protect the data and we govern it appropriately and use it wisely.
And do you see, so we have a question here from the audience, speaking of data on cybersecurity. And the question is, what are we seeing today about cybersecurity concerns? And is this impacting the pace of innovation? And I think you can thank or hate somebody for that question in the audience. But do either of you want to opine on that, on especially, you know, if that pertains to data?
Yeah, I think that you know, I can talk about it sort of in the context of IoT, but it's obviously a much broader topic. But I would say cybersecurity is one of the biggest challenges, but also one of the biggest opportunities. In this context, obviously we've seen a lot of let's say denial of service attacks leveraging cameras somewhere in Vietnam that had a default name and password mm-hmm. hard coded in them, right? And so to some degree, we also have seen for many enterprises this sort of, I would say, very naive approach of security by obscurity. I hope my my power plant is not connected, then thus it's secure, right? And then people are realizing by using basic discovery tools that no, actually there is a bunch of virtual private networks going into your plant and you just didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, my sense is let's be rational about it. Let's look at what we've seen in sort of IT world for many decades, a rational approach to risk and investment, right? And also let's leverage the best practices. Let's look at policy-based architecture that look at before, because every enterprise will get hacked. It's a question of when versus if, but also during, how we can make sure that if there is a hack, let's say, into the hospital, that we can discover it in seconds and not in months. And then after, how do we remediate the problem? So my take is, yes, the industry is getting together. I think we are seeing collaboration across the security vendors, across the industry players. The governments are getting involved, sometimes sort of focusing on legislation, but in most cases, I think working with the industry. But more importantly, the enterprises, I think, are taking a rational approach to it. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually optimistic. I believe we can solve these problems. It's always a race because you're dealing with an active adversary, but we can take an architectural approach and minimize the potential challenges, the potential damage.
Okay. Alex, we're going to shift back towards innovation. We have somebody who wants you to name names on who does corporate innovation well besides Cisco. And so either you can and this question has a little bit of context around it. Big companies succeed or fail on forecasts and protecting existing positions. Startups succeed or fail on pursuit of new opportunities. Let's name names. Besides Cisco, who does startup speed corporate innovation well? Or you can tell us of some process that you admire that is being done well. But some treat to throw the audience on.
We had time to think about it, right?
So one example I think will kind of satisfy both, but it's Adobe, right? If I think about the Adobe, they came up with this idea. They're the pioneers of kind of employee empowerment. They came up with this idea of Adobe Kickbox that we actually leveraged at Cisco when we've built our program, and that's about giving tools, training, resources, and dollars to employees to pursue their ideas, and they've been highly successful with that, not only in their company, but I've known of dozens of companies that are, they basically put it in public domain, and there are a lot of companies that are enabling that. So if you're with a large company, take a look at Adobe Kickbox. That's a good practice that's helping them, helping Cisco, and helping others.
I mean, I can give you lots of examples of, in particular, domains. I think Intel and GE did a great job of investing in the ecosystem. You can look at SAP, how they build an ecosystem of startups. We actually been partnering with BCG Digital Ventures. They actually are sort of the masters of working with large enterprises on how to actually incubate businesses. So, I mean, my answer was not necessarily that I was trying to avoid the naming the companies, but honestly. Most of the Fortune 100 companies do some aspects of innovation well.
Yeah. We have another question about staying private versus going public, and how does that impact innovation? So you're seeing a lot of companies at incredibly high valuations that are not just unicorns, not even decacorns, but you know these 30 to plus billion-dollar valuations. And there's a strong motivation to stay private, I think, by a lot of founders because you don't have to be beholden to the quarterly reporting of a public company and also the short-term focus that sometimes creates. Do you think it is an asset or a liability when it comes to innovation to be a public company versus an equally resourced private company?
It's a big debate, right, in the industry. My take on this is that I actually do believe being public has a lot of advantages. And you know, let's look at Amazon, right? That they've had a very long-term focus, not a quarter-by-quarter focus, and the street has rewarded them with the big valuations. What the benefit of being public is? It is transparency, it's ethics, it is I would say probably these sort of things. So because we've also seen the dark side of not being accountable for some of these things.
Alex, any thoughts?
Just one other thing is being a public company, it creates that kind of pressure from your investors and from the environment. It's more pressure. And in order to thrive with innovation, you have to have that pressure, right? I think that's very important.
Okay, I'm going to go to another question, and I'll give some context to myself before I ask this. There's this sort of Zen meditation exercise that you do where you're meditating on your own death, and it's very sort of sad, but it actually...
If you live in the Matrix, you don't have a problem.
Yes, yeah. I think that's, if you go to the other side, you just take the red pill, and it's you can perceive the same thing in two totally different ways. But I think the idea behind this is it's actually can be a very enlivening experience if you can confront your own death. I say that as a setup to this question because this other question from the audience is what innovations are you most worried about that could disrupt Cisco's business? And I don't know if you guys also go through that sort of thought exercise of thinking about what could kill us and then thinking about strategies against this. But what would you, if you were playing devil's advocate, what innovations would you be most worried about that could disrupt or displace Cisco?
I mean, from that perspective, we always have to be paranoid. But I'm not that worried about the technologies. Mm-hmm. I think I worry about complacency. I worry about culture. I worry about lack of talent. And all of those things are sort of connected, right? To some degree, going full circle to a discussion around innovation in a digital age, how do we continue to be proactive in staying an innovative company? Mm-hmm. Because then I think you can see. I mean, we have a lot of tools to look ahead and look at what technologies are out there. We can invest, we can incubate, we can buy, as long as the culture and sort of the how we run the company is right.
And how do you know if you're succeeding at that?
It's a good question, but I think that for me, it is. Last night I had dinner with one of the members of a Founders Forum. He was a CEO of a company. Now he's running our Spark organization. And I was actually asking him that question, which is, how much freedom do you have? How much risk you can take? How can you attract talent? Tell me the difference between you running your own show versus now you're running a show within the large company. Mm-hmm. And I think his answers were very positive, meaning, hey, I can leverage Cisco and I can now build my business much faster. I am able to attract even Stanford grads, right? So to some degree, for me, it's sort of, you can have all kinds of metrics, and I'm sure we have, but for me, it's these kind of conversations. Mm-hmm. When I talk to people who leave Cisco, right, and here, I talked to a recently a person that she was one of the founders and left Cisco, mm-hmm. and she said, well, these are the things that actually I am frustrated about, right? And okay, now I know we need to fix those.
Yep.
So you need to stay on top of the feedback and don't stay in an ivory tower. Just go to the troops and talk to people.
Yep. Alex, any?
It's same thing. It's about getting too comfortable. It's about having a tunnel vision, right? And it's just making sure that you constantly need to disrupt yourself. Otherwise, somebody else will disrupt you.
And do you measure that, though? I mean, everybody says, people say that all the time, but few people actually deliver on that. Are you guys internalizing that in some way, in an actionable way, where you're measuring something to ensure that you're staying?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, the first Maciek mentioned is the exit feedback of people leaving the company. It's actually why, right? It's about being candid about that. And the second one is it's about the employee sentiment and just making sure that people are working cross-functionally.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that a lot of this is around examples, right? That like the Innovate Everywhere Challenge that your team runs, right? That if you see successful examples of people who came up with ideas and their ideas and the organization helped them get these ideas to fruition or to market, then it is viral, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The reverse is also true. Mm-hmm. If you have frustrated people who tried and said, okay, I need to leave the company and do the Sun Hill Road to get funded, the reverse is true.
Keeping them in is toxic, you're saying, if people want to leave?
No, I mean, what I mean is that helping individuals succeed, and once they succeed, and we have a couple of these success stories, mm-hmm. I think there's an avalanche that follows. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side also, if you have people who basically left the company because they felt frustrated, they couldn't get their idea out, mm-hmm. it's also toxic.
Yeah, it's toxic to the company.
To the company.
Yeah, whenever yep. It's all about keep the people and yeah.
And again, it's about examples, right?
Is there any tech startup that you would fund right now if you could play VC, any stage? Which tech startup would you fund?
Since I already believe I live in a matrix, so from that perspective, I would actually focus more on long-term disruptive. And I'm a bit of an idealist at my age. That's what you do, right? So so I would not focus on, okay, here's the next quick opportunity to sell off to a large company in the next 2 years. But areas, around deep learning, around bioengineering, around healthcare. There are a lot of fascinating areas that potentially can make us superhuman, that can extend our lives, that can get rid of poverty. And I'll focus more on the long term.
Okay. But this, I don't want to make this a Miss America pageant, because I want to get specific around like specific names. Is there any specific startup that you really loved that you would actually
there are many.
Fund? And you can and you can throw the Maciek brand behind a startup now if you want to.
Uh-uh.
But okay, there's many. There's many.
There are many.
There's not one that you would endorse.
Yep.
Alex, if there is, you're welcome to share. If not, it's your prerogative. Okay. Let me then ask the classic. Can I ask the classic Peter Thiel contrarian question? So Peter Thiel is a big advocate of that. You know, it's oftentimes lacking when it comes to really finding something distinctive is not competence, but it's uniqueness. And so one of the questions that he asks when he's assessing anything, whether it be a company or an employee, is what important truth do you believe in that few people would agree with you on? And it's a simple-sounding question, but it's oftentimes very difficult to answer. But the intent is to get into some insight that you strongly believe in, where you might be in the minority on. How would you answer that question? What important truth, it could be anything, do you believe that few people would actually agree with you on?
So I don't think I'm that original, to be honest, but I can give you a couple of sort of random thoughts. One is Internet of Things is real and it's making a big impact. Blockchain is will have a probably as big of an impact as Internet had in the 90s. In general, I would say AI will create a lot of good, and in general, I am optimistic that technology is something that will make us happy.
That was four. That was great. Just to double click on that first one, that IoT is real and is already happening.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that IoT is overhyped. Can you speak to why that's not true in your mind and why you think it's, in fact, already happening and it's real?
By the way, I don't know why we talk about hype as a negative thing. You know, okay. Quite often hype is actually quite positive, right? Because if we didn't hype up IoT a couple of years ago, we wouldn't have dozens of startups that are focusing on it. We wouldn't have a bunch of vertically integrated companies like opening up their architectures. We wouldn't have customers asking for open ecosystems. So I mean, there's a lot of things that come with people sort of having awareness, this thing is happening, what do I do about it? Having said that, when you go to CES and you see connected toasters and connected fridges and you sort of scratch your head, why people would do that? Just because you can connect doesn't mean that you should, right? Then you sort of look at, okay, this is a hype thing. But the reality is that there are tens of thousands of organizations that actually have been implementing IoT, mostly in the first phase to improve existing processes. You have Harley Davidson, who reduced the time it took for you and I to order a new configuration of a bike from a year and a half to 2 weeks, right? You have a startup in an ice cream chain in India that now sort of prevented their ice cream to get melt basically because the power is going down. You have Maersk, you have General Motors putting preventive maintenance kind of solutions. So the dozens and dozens of use cases and examples where enterprises are improving their operations and starting to transform their businesses.
And I'm playing devil's advocate. Obviously, we have an IoT program with an Alchemist, and we're big fans. Mm-hmm. But if you're saying that it's real right now, that it's happening right now,
yep.
And somebody wants to go into IoT, is there an entry point that you would recommend? Should they go after a horizontal platform, a vertical solution?
Yep.
If it is really real, beyond just the hype, I'm not saying hype is bad, but if there's real revenue, and depending upon how you're defining real, what guidance would you give somebody who wants to have an impact?
Actually, I wrote an article about it recently, and I think similar to what we talked about with blockchain and with AI, very much so in IoT, you either have to be a horizontal specialist, whether you focus on management or visualization or security or so forth, and then you have to build an ecosystem of vertical partners around you. Or you have to go deep into one use case, one vertical, and sort of a customer intimacy. The sort of a misconception, especially here in the Valley, we had this view of, you know, if you get a billion customers, somehow the business model will emerge and things will happen, right? And we had some positive examples of that. But IoT is different, right? It's not one market. It's a collection of markets. It's and sub-markets and ecosystems within these markets. And by the way, these markets are huge. If you think about industrial automation, it's a $200 billion market. So if you focus on this one market and you focus on providing security solutions to this market, it could easily be just one use case that can, can take you all the way to IPO.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Terrific. Alex, we're going to return to the Teal question to you. It can be any truth. What is one important truth that you believe in that few people would agree with you on?
outside of Silicon Valley. That's one disclaimer. But I think all my life I believe in that form follows thought, and if you can imagine it, you can create it. And I talk to a lot of
that
people.
That form follows thought.
Yes.
Okay. That you can materialize.
If you can imagine it, you can create it. And I think what we're seeing a lot of that in Silicon Valley, right? But we often don't see that in big companies with employees, right? We often, like I grew up in Soviet Union. I think the entire country doesn't believe in this, right? Which is obvious to me that if you can imagine, you can create something. But it goes back to self-empowerment. And I think that many people don't believe that they have the opportunities, but indeed they have. There's plenty of people that are working, willing to work with them. There's plenty of capital. There's tons of opportunities.
Well, let's go into that because I think when it comes to innovation, there's sort of two emerging schools of thought. One is vision comes first, and whatever you envision is what you create. And it's sort of this teleological idea, sort of top down, that I can conceive of a world this way, and then you create that world. At Stanford, there's been this whole shift towards the design school, which is really shifting the way we're teaching innovation from a teleological to a more process-driven approach, that the endpoint is going to change, and so it's all about pivoting and changing and applying design thinking. And so what you're teaching is a process, not necessarily content. So it's about empathy and iteration, mm-hmm. And it's these process-driven muscles that you're trying to train to build innovations. Do you have a school of thought when it comes to building truly disruptive innovations? Does it happen from a vision first that you follow through with conviction, or does it happen from a process that where you surrender to what the end point is going to look like and you let the process take you to a place that you never even could have imagined?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think these things could perfectly coexist, and they're coexisting, right? I mean, in order to go and embark on a certain journey, you still have to have faith, and then you're willing to take risks, right? So it's having a vision of getting somewhere. You may not know the final destination. Mm-hmm. Of course, in any discovery process, you're going to pivot, mm-hmm. right? But I think it's about being – but in order to pivot, you have to be open, right, to different things, so you don't have to have a tunnel vision. So it's about being able to start that journey.
But when you guys think about innovation internally within Cisco, how do you decide when to kill something versus saying that this thing just hasn't run its course yet, it just needs a little bit more time? That decision manifests itself both within big corporations as well as startups, whether to pivot or not, whether to fund or kill. How do you guys make decisions? How do you do that? Because that's really where the rubber hits the road with that tension.
I mean, in our shop, it's a funnel, right? And we actually go through the very structured process of going through the candidates and not only which areas to focus, but also how. Mm-hmm. Whether we let the market decide and then we decide to buy the winners, or whether we invest, or whether we monitor, or whether we actually incubate. So it's actually a very structured process. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, like with the VC, our CFO will ask us a lot of tough questions before she gives us money. Right?
But then how do you not fall victim then to this issue of killing something too soon based because of short-term demands or short-term milestones, when if you let it percolate a little bit more, you could have fumbled towards victory?
I mean, I can give you an example. We looked at drones, right? And we had an effort going on, started monitoring drones. Then we started looking into the opportunities. And obviously, as a networking company, we looked at, okay, here's another bunch of devices we can connect, but is there more to it, right? We look at fog computing or distributed cloud. And at the end of the day, we concluded that we couldn't add enough value, and we decided to monitor. Mm-hmm. So in this case, yes, we may come back to it in a year or two, but for now, we didn't think there was enough. The business case wasn't strong enough.
Okay, because you were looking at your internal assets and what value you could have added to that, and that didn't pass that bar.
Yep.
Alex, any thoughts around this, around how to decide when to kill versus fund decisions? Because that's really where the rubber hits the road oftentimes internally.
Well, I work with a lot of employee projects, right, that are brought on by employees or group of employees, which may or may not be connected to their work. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, we have a structured process, but it's all about convincing others, right? In a large company or in a startup, in order to be successful, in order to get to revenue, you have to convince others, right? So they need to convince other employees. They need to convince executives and stakeholders to keep moving. And if they don't have that ability, that's...
And is there an API that creates that match between two different people that are seeing things differently? If you believe Peter Thiel that contrarians change the world, and it's fervent minorities that have to convince blasé majorities, mm-hmm. Whether you agree with Peter Thiel and other philosophies or not, I don't mean to be more just this notion that the world is inherently will be changed by people who see the world differently, mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, and you have does passion play a role in those discussions, or is it a rational discourse of hitting certain objective criteria? Is it a process-driven decision, or is it an objective-based decision?
Well, I think it's about both, right? I think it's about both around the passion and the process, right? Because at the end of the day, with any innovation, you have to have a dream and you have to have a discipline. Otherwise, nothing is going to come out of it, right? But again, at Cisco, what we believe in, not every single person will have an idea, right? And there will be people with ideas, right? Let's call them founders, right? But in order to thrive, they need a support network, angels and mentors. So what we've created a mentoring network around the company that's based on helping, just informally helping other people in the company get their ideas moving. And I think it's just, to me, it's important that they can create that community around their idea and convince others.
Yeah, I mean, being entrepreneurial is hard, whether you do it in a startup or you do it in a large company, right? So so from that perspective, how do you reduce the friction? How do you enable people through processes and mentoring and funding mechanisms and so forth, right? And I do believe that if you do it right, the right ideas will come.
Yep. We're nearing the end. Unfortunately, we've reached the point where we have limited time left. I have tasked Alex and Maciek to end with one final takeaway. And what I've asked them to do is to distill that takeaway down to just six words. So this is inspired by the purported novel and challenge that was given to Ernest Hemingway. I don't know if it's actually true or not, that could Ernest Hemingway actually write a novel in six words? And he wrote this very sad six-word statement, which was, "For sale, baby shoes, never used," which is apparently the first sort of six-word novella. And I didn't mean to end on that depressing note, but it's more about brevity. Brevity can be the soul of wit. And I wanted Alex and Maciek both to get the final word. And so I've asked them each to give us a six-word takeaway to end this beautiful evening with. And so I will kick it off with Alex.
All right, I'll give it to you in three. Innovators, not innovations.
Innovators, not innovations.
Innovations.
Awesome. Maciek?
I don't know how many words, but innovation is the mindset.
Innovation is the mindset. That's mm-hmm. fantastic. That was four words. All right, terrific. Well, please, everybody, join me. Our thanks to Alex Goryajev, Managing Director of Innovation Strategy and Programs at Cisco Systems, and Maciek Kranz, Vice President of Strategic Innovations at Cisco Systems, and the author of Building the Internet of Things, Implement New Business Models, Disrupt Competitors, Transform Your Industry. We also thank everyone here, as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been generously supported by Accenture. I'm Ravi Balani, Managing Director of Alchemist, an accelerator for enterprise startups, and a lecturer at Stanford University. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.